This is the Citizen of Heaven podcast number 207, Magic. I am Hal Hammonds, and I am a Citizen of Heaven, and your embedded correspondent in Satan's world. Thanks for checking in this week. Magic is a term we use to describe things that make no sense, things that defy description. Whether it's real or not depends on the sort of magic you're talking about, and there are several. This week we will discuss the magic we see in every starry sky and the true power behind it, the two different kinds of magic in Narnia and which is stronger, the magic being worked on us by the powers that be and who knows who else, and the magic show you can put on in your very own living room. We'll start with what I've been preaching. A man stands on his back porch, staring up into a starry sky. His jaw literally drops as he considers the beauty, the majesty, the sheer size of it all. He considers the immense power and force required to put every bit of it in its place. And as if to spoil the moment, he thinks about people all over the world, staring at the same sky, surely as much in awe of it all as he is, but who see a much different picture behind it all. They insist on complicating things with half-baked theories, wild speculations, and stories told to them that they ignorantly and lazily glom onto. "Why do you have to make it so difficult for yourselves?" he asks all the strangers out there. "Why can't you just believe?" If you heard that story and assumed it was the observations of a Christian, a believer in intelligent design, then rewind and listen again. This time, assume it's an atheist instead. Go ahead, I'll wait. Works both ways, doesn't it? We hear all the time from evolutionists about the simplicity of the Christian mind. God is the answer for everything. Just wave your magic wand and God will make all the questions go away. But doesn't the same thing apply to the evolutionist? Don't they wind up making the same arguments? I can't get into a full-scale battle here over which side of the argument is truly more consistent, although you probably know how I would come down on that issue. But let's at least acknowledge that there are leaps of faith on both sides. I'm sure there are dedicated, intellectually honest people on the cutting edge of science out there, digging and scratching, whiteboards full of equations, scouring the latest scientific reports. Sure, they will find sufficient putty to fill in all the holes in all the arguments they've made over the years. But I'm also sure there are high school biology teachers by the thousands who absolutely dread it when one of their students asks, for instance, "But what was before the Big Bang?" Or, "How does an arm actually become a wing? And how did feathers just start growing on a reptile for no reason?" Or, "If the moon is millions of years old with no atmosphere, why weren't the lunar modules swallowed in cosmic dust?" And eventually those teachers will break down and say the same thing they ridicule preachers for saying. "Look, people who know this business better than you and me put together have worked all this out. Why do you have to make it so difficult for yourself? Why can't you just believe?" For the record, since I'm the one that brought this up, I have never brushed off a legitimate inquiry into the truth behind origins, either from a believer or from a skeptic, and God willing, I never will. I love asking questions. I love finding answers. I'd be a hypocrite if I denied someone else the same privileges. Yes, I think entrenched atheists would make it easier for themselves if they would open themselves up to the possibility of faith in God. But I don't ask them to suspend their quest for knowledge. In fact, I think every bit of information they find about the amazing world we live in will support the idea of a God who was and is behind it all. The more I study about biology, for instance, the more I realize the real magic trick would be getting life to come from lifelessness. The more I study about geology, the more I realize the real magic trick would be burying millions of years of sediment under sediment that was millions of years older. And when I look at a starry sky and start reciting Psalm 8 in my head, it's not because I'm stupid or anti-science. It's because I have an answer to life's mysteries with which I am 100% satisfied. I'll be glad to fill in the blanks here and there as science provides opportunity. But I will take the Bible's so-called magical explanation over pure rationalism any day. I'm not going to believe in atheistic evolution just because some smart people said I should. And I'm not expecting you to believe in God just because I sound like I know what I'm talking about. I'm saying there's an explanation for everything. Either God made everything or nothing made everything. You decide for yourself which one sounds more like magic. This is what I've been reading. Like many or most of you, the first religious fiction book I ever read was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis. Again, like many or most of you, I didn't understand it that way at the time. I was probably only 8 or 9, and I was given no context before I picked the book up. So I thought it was just a book about a magical world with magical creatures and a magical lion who's trying to bring good things to the good guys and defeat the cause of the bad guys. In hindsight, I think I understood a lot more of the religious allegories than I realized. I just didn't think books could be written to make a shallow point and a deeper, more important point at the same time. My reading level is a bit higher now, I like to think, and now I see the Narnia series as an outstanding example, perhaps the best ever written, of putting the Jesus story in a fictitious setting. The most beautiful part of the book, surely, is where Aslan the Lion submits himself to execution in place of the traitor Edmund. I can remember the whole time thinking there was some sort of trick up his sleeve, or would be if lions wore sleeves. I remember being horrified that the White Witch was declaring victory in a matter wholly not of her own making. I remember disgust at the cavorting of her minions dancing around the stone table, mocking and shaming the one who clearly was far greater than any of them. This can't be real, I thought to myself. Well, of course it isn't real, silly, it's a book. Even so, surely this can't be the way the story ends. And of course it isn't. And when Aslan appears to Lucy alive after his death, he explains to her the how and the why. It's an older, deeper magic, he said, unknown to the White Witch. She had no way of knowing that accepting the death of an innocent one in the place of the guilty would be precisely the key to unraveling the eternal winter she had brought upon the world. I don't have time to point out all the references to the story of the cross in the Narnia series, or even really to properly discuss the ones I just mentioned. But I will take a moment to discuss the idea of what Lewis calls magic in the Narnia story. Call it what you like in the Bible story. Power, signs, authority. It's Satan's ability to interact in the world, deepening his influence over those who, knowingly or unknowingly, lie under the weight of the debt they owe to him. I wouldn't call it magic because of the specific connotations that term has in our culture, but if you wanted to call it magic, I wouldn't criticize you for it. And the forms it takes in the Bible occasionally look like what we would typically call magic. Pharaoh's sorcerers turning sticks into serpents, for instance. The divination of the demon-possessed girl in Ephesus. The sorcery of Elymas and Simon. Was some of that mere trickery? Perhaps. But not all of it. Clearly, though, the presence of this sort of magic was present for two related reasons. One, of course, was to showcase the deeper magic. The power and authority of our Creator God, especially as seen through His Son, Jesus. Even in something as simple as Moses' serpent swallowing the serpents of Pharaoh's magicians, God's work always triumphs over the devil's work. Sometimes, like at Mount Carmel with Elijah and the prophets of Baal, it's as simple as one power showing up and the other one being off on vacation somewhere. And sometimes it takes the form of a pitched battle between the forces of good and forces of evil, with good triumphing. And the greatest example of this is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The forces of evil brought everything to bear in removing Jesus from the earth. And then the Father brought him back again. And this could not be dismissed easily as a mere conjurer's trick. This was power, pure and simple, deeper, older, and greater. I said two reasons. The second is not quite so positive. The fact is, as much as we would like to ignore it, most humans are like Edmund. They see the witch. They are drawn to her. They are captivated by her. And unlike Edmund, they stay with her forever. They learn to love and serve her. They embrace eternal winter. And no matter how much we may show them another better way, they stubbornly cling to sin. I don't know how magical the deception of wickedness and deluding influence of 2 Thessalonians 2 verses 8 through 12 are, or how much their nature has changed over the years. But the lawless one remains in one form or another, and he has power to deceive. We see it working every day. I urge you to embrace the deeper magic, the power that sent Jesus to earth, that brought him up from the grave, that will guard and protect us as God's people throughout our days here, and ultimately usher us into a greater, higher existence with him in the world to come. Magic is real. Choose the kind that connects you to the Lion of Judah, not the kind that mocks and ridicules him, that might seem to be carrying the day in the moment. This is what I've been hearing. I got shackles on my wrists. Soon I'll slip them and I'll be gone. Chain me in a box in the river and I'll rise singing this song. Trust none of what you hear and less of what you see. This is what will be. This is what will be. I got a shiny saw blade. All I need is a volunteer. I'll cut you in half while you're smiling ear to ear. And that freedom you saw, it's drifting like a ghost among the trees. This is what will be. This is what will be. Those are lines from the title track of Bruce Springsteen's 15th studio album, released in 2007. The title is Magic, and it's not about Harry Houdini or David Blaine. If you were to catch Mr. Springsteen in an honest moment, he might tell you it is about George W. Bush. But in a broader sense, it's about living in a world where you can't accept things at face value. Everything is misdirection. Everyone is trying to pull one over on you. It's all hidden agendas, cover stories, and the inevitable betrayal of confidence. It's a pretty cynical outlook, to be honest. Probably one of the reasons I don't listen to Bruce Springsteen much anymore. I don't like living in that headspace. But just because I find that idea disturbing doesn't mean it isn't true. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's far more true than we're allowed to believe by those who control such things. There's very little I detest more than being played. I can take a prank as well as the next person, but being exploited because of misplaced confidence, hearing that someone lied to my face and laughed about it with his friends afterward, that really gets my blood boiling. And there's not much that can do that either. I'm a pretty mild-mannered guy. Once upon a time, I thought the best way to avoid this sort of humiliation was to get as much knowledge as I could manage about the world, the government, my friends and enemies, all the above. Whatever I could do to avoid being the joke in someone else's magic show, that's what I wanted to do. But I never got the impression that my efforts really made much of a difference. I didn't expose any tricksters who were trying to get into my head or my wallet. I certainly didn't convince myself that all my worries were for nothing, that in fact there was no one out to get me, the opposite of anything. All that I accomplished really was less sleep, more angst, and a generally negative view of the world. I changed my tactics a few years ago. I turned the music off, both literally and figuratively. I chose to focus on me and my responsibilities, rather than the tactics of people who likely weren't going to change despite my best efforts. It's the approach Paul takes repeatedly when counseling Timothy. Bad people will do bad things. You make sure you keep yourself pure. In 1 Timothy 6, starting at verse 3, he discusses those who reject the sound words of the gospel. He calls them conceited, says they're obsessed with controversy and disputes, that a love of money is at the core of it more often than not. And in verse 11, he writes, "But flee from these things, you man of God, and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness." Again, in 2 Timothy 3, he says men will come in. I think he means Christians here, who are characterized by love of self, love of money, arrogance, ingratitude, and a host of other character flaws. And in verse 13, he says, they will go from bad to worse and take others with them. You, however, he says in verse 14, continue in the things you have learned and become convinced of. Again, in 2 Timothy 4, he warns of brethren who will not endure sound doctrine. They will turn from the truth and turn aside to myths. Verse 5, but you, be sober in all things, endure hardship, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry. There are tricksters in the world, always have been. I can't change that, and neither can you. All you can do is be wise to their efforts in a general sense. And then just keep your head down and do the job God gives you to do. Be wise as serpents and innocent as doves, as Jesus says in Matthew 10:16. It's not flashy. You'll likely never headline and act in Las Vegas like some of those characters. But you'll be impressing the only audience that truly matters. This is what I've been playing. Tricarion, Legends of Illusion, is a board game in which you play the part of an actual magician, one of several vying for the biggest audiences and biggest paydays at the auditorium downtown. You choose the act you want to perform, buy the necessary implements, hire assistants, and practice, practice, practice. If you get all your ducks in a row properly, or rabbits in your hat if you prefer, you can become the greatest magician in town, or at least the greatest in your living room. The trick, pardon the expression, is to plan well, which is undoubtedly why I do so poorly at this game. Am I whining again? Feels like I've been whining a lot in the last few weeks. I apologize. I will try to find some games to discuss for future episodes that don't make me feel like an idiot. Anyway, planning. If you're the first to choose a performance slot, you can set yourself up to get the best crowd. But if someone performs your trick before you get a chance, he'll steal your thunder and your reputation. You could try to get an earlier slot, but what if you haven't learned the trick by then? Your turn will largely be wasted, and this is a game in which you can't afford to waste much. Every move matters. Personally, I'm fascinated by magic acts. And actually becoming a magician is a pretty exciting prospect. But like anything else, if you want to get good at it, you'll have to put in a tremendous amount of effort. You likely will stumble and fall any number of times. Just hope you're not in a locked cage underwater when it happens, or in a box about to be filled with swords. But if you learn from your mistakes, and if you're truly committed to excellence, in time you'll be able to make this look easy. But looking easy is not the same as being easy. If it were truly easy, anyone could do it. Learn the trick first, then figure out how to execute the trick. Then get to where you can seamlessly perform the trick. That seems to be the way it works, not that I'm any kind of expert. What trick are you trying to perform these days? Maybe it's preaching a sermon or leading a Bible study. Maybe you're rearing children. Maybe you're trying to teach the gospel to a friend. It seems so easy when other people do it. Trust me, it isn't magic. It's work. Hard work. It's never not hard work. The day the most experienced performer mails the effort in, that's the day the critic is in the building. It's dangerous to think that certain people in your life, your preacher, your parents, your Bible class teachers, or whoever, do what they do simply because they have a special innate ability that carries them effortlessly through hardships, obstacles, and unforeseen circumstances. I will almost guarantee you that is not the case. If they appear at ease in circumstances that would make you break out in hives, that's because they were not satisfied staying where you are right now. They wanted to get better. They put in the hours. They got help. They built a program and rehearsed it. Yes, maybe God drops a talent in their lap out of nowhere. But more often than not, it's because that person was doing such a good job with the five talents he already had. Jesus has hired you to join his team, his band of performers, if you will. At first, it won't be flashy. You may not get the primetime slot. That's okay. You're almost certainly not ready for it anyway. Take what time you have to learn. Take the faith that God has blessed you with and get busy adding moral excellence, knowledge, self-control, perseverance, godliness, brotherly kindness, and love. We could probably list some more opportunities for growth, but focusing on those is a great start. 2 Peter 1:8 says you will be neither useless nor unfruitful if you will give yourself to this process. And always remember, Jesus is there the whole time, holding your hand, guiding your steps, helping you develop into the Christian he knows you're capable of being. He will do everything in his power to get you from where you started to where you want to go. You do everything in your own power to help him. You have been listening to the Citizen of Heaven podcast. Thank you for your support. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe through your favorite podcast platform and or on YouTube. Comments, corrections, and suggestions are always welcome. Please feel free to follow me through Facebook, MeWe, Parler, or Instagram, or check out my webpage, www.halhammonds.com. Until next time, be strong and courageous, fight the good fight of faith, and do all things in the name of the Lord Jesus. This is Hal Hammonds, the Citizen of Heaven, signing off.